About 8 to 10 miles northwest of Munich, in Bavaria, Germany, there is a small, rather unpretentious village. In that village, there stands a monument that, like all monuments, represents a memory. But unlike most monuments, it is a memory of despair and horror. It has been designed by those who wish for those who pass by never to forget the horror of what happened in that place. Strangely, at that same site, there once stood another sign, a sign that carried with it a message that was a lie. Those who put the sign there hoped that it would be believed as the truth. That sign read, "Work makes you free." And people were brought into the concentration camp at Dachau with that before them. Work hard and you will someday be free. You and I know that nothing could have been further from the truth, for those who worked the hardest died the youngest. They believed that false message, many of them, until it was too late to understand that it was really a lie. Today, there are 32 slabs of cement that stand as stark, naked reminders of the real truth of Dachau. There are 3 gaunt, emaciated statues of men, shells of humanity, one representing the Germans, another the Jews, and a third the Christians who died in the slave camp and in the ovens of Dachau. And the small monument that has been erected in the place where tradition has it the sun never shines reads, "Remember the victims." And that is the truth. But it's too late for the victims. In God's grand book, He has written a sign. It's a strange sign that many who are in a hurry will pass by because it's wedged between Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and it seems so unimportant and insignificant, it really doesn't even carry much of a prophecy. So prophecy buffs would pass it over for the morsels that are found in the other great books of prophecy. But I tell you, there is a pulsating sign that comes out of Lamentations that says, "Remember the victims." You see, they believed 40 years earlier that another message was the truth. Sin pays rich dividends. Was that 40-year-ago message in their lives? That it's fun to disobey and you won't have to worry much about it because you get what you want and it's a delight. There are ecstasies connected with sinful activities and they will always overshadow the consequences. Live and let live. 40 years later, Jeremiah, alone in the city, writes another epilogue, and it says, "No, remember the victims." In my few years in the church, I have not ever heard a message on the harsh truth of Lamentations. And so it was about a year ago I undertook a careful study of the book that some of you will remember. It altered many lives, and I heard a number of responses from people who have heard that on tape or on some radio program in the months that followed. There's something about the book that rings true but is so seldom heard. The name of the book is very unusual. All the other prophecies have the names of the men, but this one has an action of a prophet. It's a word that you won't use in 20 years of life in America. You will never refer to Lamentations. It's a word that means to wail, to cry out in grief, to regret strongly, to mourn aloud. It's what you would expect to hear at a funeral procession, for that's what it is. J. Sidlow Baxter says, this is an elegy written in a graveyard, a memorial dirge, a cloudburst of grief, a river of tears, a sea of sobs, a great throne draped in mourning. The date of Lamentations is 586 B.C. It means nothing to Americans. It means everything to the historic Jew. It is the day of infamy in the Hebrew history. It's the day the nation died. It's the December 7, 1941 of their lives. It's 1861 to them. It's the day that the truth finally won out and the nation fell. And the king's eyes were bored out of his head, and the bloated bodies of the people popped under the sun in the streets of Jerusalem. And the cries of the victims as they walked away chained to one another on their way to Babylon could be heard across the windswept hills of Judah. It was the end of the line. It was a day to cry. So Jeremiah just shoves aside the sophistication that often wrapped itself around the well-known prophets, and he cried with them. But like a war correspondent walking through the remains of the battlefield, he put down some notes in a journal, and they have come to us in the book of Lamentations. It's interesting, the Bible never once specifically says Jeremiah wrote it. Never once. Tradition says that he did. It fits in the books according to that scene. It has his style. It has his characteristic Hebrew phrases, and the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, puts a unique kind of prefix before the beginning of the book. It reads, "It came to pass after Israel was taken captive and Jerusalem made desolate, Jeremiah sat weeping and lamented this lamentation over Jerusalem." The Latin Vulgate adds, "He wrote it in bitterness of heart, sighing and crying." Ever written a letter while you were crying? Then you understand what Jeremiah went through. And so you'd expect it to be an emotional book, and he doesn't apologize for it. You get very emotional when your nation has died, and you see your close friends and people who were a part of your ministry killed in the streets, and starvation finally take its terrible toll, and children as well as adults swept away as in a flood. You get emotional about that. Just before you look into Lamentations with me, I want you to go back and see the earlier sign that says it's okay to do your thing. Jeremiah chapter 5. Let's go back 40 years before this book. The last two verses of Jeremiah 5, verses 30 and 31 of the fifth chapter. Here's our friend Jeremiah, good man, pure man, weeping friend. "An appalling and horrible thing has happened in the land. First, the prophets prophesy falsely. Second, the priests rule on their own authority. And the tragedy of it is my people love it so." Isn't that something? False prophets are rampant in the land and people applaud them. Priests are doing their own thing and people like that. Jeremiah, with his heart wrung before the people, asks the question that ought to be asked on the front end of sin. What will you do at the end of it? Oh, I'll tell you, Jeremiah is a confronter. And he taps this sinning nation on the shoulder and he says, wait a minute, could I have your attention for a moment? Turn around. What are you going to do when the bottom drops out? All of us have had on occasion a few friends close enough to ask us that kind of hard question. And we give God thanks for every remembrance of those kind of people. The first kind of people like that were our parents. And they ask hard questions like, you realize what this is going to lead to? Remember those questions? Oh, you want to say, be quiet. And they pull your hand away and they say, no, it's my job as your parent to remind you that down the road you're going to pay a price if you live like that now. That's Jeremiah, like a divine parent asking the nation, what are you going to do at the end of this kind of lifestyle? Well, they ignored him because they read the wrong sign. Work makes you free. Sin sets you free. No. No, it makes you a victim. It doesn't free you, it turns you into a slave. And that's what he tells us about in the book of Lamentations. Turn to the 5th chapter of Lamentations now. Let's go to the other side, the end of it all. 5:16. Now here are the people as they are answering back to the prophet's question. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. The major message of the book of Lamentations is sin always has its consequences. That is the message of the book. It is a book of consequences, and it tells the truth about consequences. And it tells it again and again and again and again and again, 5 chapters, so that you'll never, ever forget it. But alas, we will, sinful as we are. But it's a memorial. Whether you pass by to read it or not, it stays there. And it says, don't you forget this. Sin, like crime, never ultimately pays. Now, how is it structured? On the other side of your outline this evening, you'll see a chart of the book. There are 5 voices that speak in the book of Lamentations, 1 in each chapter. There's the voice of the city as Jeremiah personifies the city. He allows it to speak in this colorful Hebrew fashion. And then in the 2nd chapter, there's the voice of the Lord that answers sort of in an antiphonal manner. And then coming to the 3rd chapter, the voice of the prophet, followed by the voice of the possessions, the things people clung to in the days of their sinfulness. They answer. They speak. And then finally, there is the voice of the captives on their way to Babylon. It's a terribly emotional book. Look at the underlying emotions of the chapters. Lonely, groaning, angry, exhorting, broken, weeping, empty, unsatisfying, hungry, and hurting. Wrap all of that up in a package and tuck it away in your memory, because that is the backwash of sin. No matter how fun or exciting, exhilarating, or ecstatic it may be or may seem, that is what you have at the end. It stings like an adder. Think of it like this and you'll never forget it. Sin, if you wish to enter into a lifestyle of sinfulness, it's like buying a phonograph record. You get that side that you enjoy, but you also buy at the same time the flip side that always comes with the record. And Lamentations says to you, this is the flip side and you can't escape it. Play one side all you want, but there will always be the other side. And God plays no favorites. He has no exceptions. Now, I wish I could promise you that the book sort of gets lighter toward the end. No, it doesn't. It stays heavy all the way through. It's a never-to-be-forgotten, mournful kind of reminder. Remember the victims. Now, pushing our way into the book, we will move along rather hurriedly so as to pick up the major message of each of the five chapters. And I'd like to make a request, though I don't often ask such a thing. I'd like you to write down, perhaps best of all, write in your Bible, perhaps above the chapter or at the end of the chapter, the major message which seems to come out of the chapter. I'll share it with you one by one as we go through. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. Oh, that's a good beginning. When you sin and you suffer the consequences, you're never surrounded by a lot of people saying, hey, you can make it. Hang in there. We're with you during the tough times. We'll be with you now in the backwash. No, the fun folks, the fun and games, the delightful friends of the sinful times seem to always be gone when the consequences come due and you're alone sitting without anybody around to support you. In our home, we have had the privilege of housing several unwed mothers. And it's interesting how the responsible fathers were in fact irresponsible and they never came around to assist these gals going through that. That's just one of a number of illustrations that you could think of that describes the loneliness of the consequence. How lonely sits the city? She's become like a widow who was once great among the nations, who was a princess among the provinces. She was the jewel in the crown, but now has become a forced laborer. She weeps bitterly in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. She has none to comfort her. Among all her lovers, all her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Verse 5. Her adversaries have become her masters. Verse 4, the roads of Zion are in mourning because no one comes to the feasts anymore. Her gates are desolate. Verse 6, all her majesty has departed from the daughter of Zion's, of Zion. Now verse 8, Jerusalem sinned greatly. Therefore she has become an unclean thing. All who honored her despise her because they have seen her nakedness. Even she herself groans and turns away. Forgive me if this is a little too raw for you, but there's something about illicit nakedness that repulses the other partner. When it's all over and it's all said and done, the one that took advantage of you is turned off by you. That's what happened in the streets of Jerusalem. I mean, all the delight and enjoyment of that sinful lifestyle, all the idolatry and immorality that went along with it, sounded so neat and looked so satisfying. But at the end, it was repulsive. The most bored people in the world are those in the grossest form of immorality. There's no fun there. It's lonely. See their prayer in verse 20? See, O Lord, for I am in distress. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is overturned within me. I have been very rebellious. In the street, the sword slays. In the house, it is like death. Verse 22, let all their wickedness come before thee and deal with them as thou hast dealt with me. My groans are many, my heart is faint. Here's the message from chapter 1. Sin's pleasures are often shared, but its consequences must be endured alone. Sin's pleasures are often shared, but its consequences are endured alone. You will never be more alone than when you suffer the consequences of a lifestyle of disobedience. Never. The loneliest people who come to visit our pastors for counsel are those individuals that come in the backwash of a sinful, disobedient lifestyle. Invariably, they say, I feel so alone. Remember the old ancient mariner on the sea and that old albatross around his neck? It comes back as a memory on many occasions in my life. He says on one place, alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea, and not a soul took pity on me in my agony. That's the city, that's the Christian that sits alone after sinning to his fill. There is no support when the consequences come from anyone else. They're strangely absent, no matter what they promised. Now, the Lord answers back the city in chapter 2, and he describes his anger. He is angry at these people for ignoring the voice of the prophet. He says, how the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He has cast from heaven to earth the glory of Israel and has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. By the way, that's another thing to note just in passing. You lose your glory in the consequences of sin. You lose your dignity. You lose your sense of significance, your place, your reputation, your name, and that of your family. All of that is smeared. The glory is lost. Written over many a life, the old ikavod, Hebrew word meaning, where is the glory? We call it Ichabod. He says, I've written that across Zion. The place stands like stark ruins. Big, tall, black buildings smoldering. The wall is torn down. The temple is a travesty. Ichabod, where is the glory that once visited Zion? It's gone. The Lord has swallowed up. He has not spared all the habitations of Jacob. In his wrath, he has thrown down the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. Notice, he has profaned the kingdom and its princes. Drop down to verse 19. Picks up the same thought. Arise, cry aloud in the night. At the beginning of the night watches, pour out your heart like water before the presence of the Lord. Lift up your hands to him for the life of your little ones. You see, you don't sin without impunity. You don't sin without it impacting your kids. Ask God to deliver your kids as a result of this lifestyle you've chosen, for the life of your little ones who are faint because of hunger at the head of every street. See, O Lord, look, with whom hast thou dealt thus? Should women eat their offspring? Now that is hunger. The little ones who were born healthy, should priest and prophet be slain? In the sanctuary, on the ground, lie young and old, my virgins and young men have fallen by the sword. Thou hast slain them in the day of thine anger, thou hast slaughtered, not sparing. Here's the second message of Lamentations. The Lord has no favorites. All who sin suffer its consequences. You have no corner of protection because you have walked with him, lo, these many years. Nor because your mother and dad were godly do you have some kind of a special place. PKs are not protected because they're the offspring of pastors. MKs don't have some special kind of grace that keep them from the consequences. If you sin, you suffer. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. Hard message. Hard one to heed. I'd almost forgotten an experience I had when I was up in Canada, because God so completely erased it from my mind, I never had shared it. It came to me just in sharing these thoughts and lamentations in the first service, and I do so now. I was in Canada for about 8 days, really a long time. I don't like trips, and I hate trips that include a weekend. But this was one of those that I had promised I would do, and so I had been there for 5 days, and then I had a Friday night free, and then Saturday would begin another series of things, and so in the lull in between, I had called home, and nobody was there, and so I thought, well, shoot, I'll go down to the newsstand, and I'll pick up a paper, or maybe there would be some sports news, and all they had on a sports page was hockey. And so I thought, man, this is the pits. And I looked around and chose a paper and flipped a coin on the counter and walked out. And a couple of women at the hotel telephone were giggling around the telephone. And as I walked by, I smiled at them and spoke and got to the elevator and pushed the button up. And I got on the elevator, and so did they. And I pushed 6, which was my floor, and I said, what floor do you want? And they said, 6 would be fine. Well, now, I'm not often taken for Robert Redford. But I admit a momentary feeling of flattery that they would notice this squatty little four-eyed character that had a newspaper stuck under his arm. And by the time the door opened at floor 6, they said, can we get out? And I said, I'm awful busy tonight. I'm not interested. And I stepped out, and the door closed behind me, and I leaned against the wall on floor 6. And God pulled a big shade down in front of me and let me read his word. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that he also reaps. The only reason I share that with you, aside from the fact that I'm just like you are, is to tell you that God's word meets the need, if you claim it. Hey, there was nobody in Montreal that knew I was there on floor 6. Safe? No, not really. God knew I was there. My family knew I was there, and I represented this body of people. Had I said yes, you'd have gotten ripped off. And God would have taken the blow out of my ministry. Lamentations comes back time and again saying, remember the victims. How stupid to say yes in a moment of passion and spend the rest of your life wiping off all of that horrible, horrible scandal. How stupid. Oh, the enemy says, hey, how great, and nobody will ever find out. Don't you believe it? You find out, and you got to live with it. Chapter 3 turns the corner as the prophet begins to speak. I think it's significant that it's the longest of the chapters. Prophets tend to get a little long-winded at times. And so, not for 22 verses, not for 22 verses, but now for 66. By the way, isn't that interesting to you that there are 22 verses in each chapter, but the middle, and it's 66? Wonder why? Well, there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Big deal. Yeah, but in the first two chapters and in the middle chapter, it's built so that they're fitted together in an acrostic manner. If you read the Hebrew, the first verse of chapter 1 starts with an aleph. The second verse of chapter 1 starts with a beit. The third verse of chapter 1 starts with a gimel. And the fourth verse of chapter 1 starts with a dalet. And you work all the way through the alphabet. And you get to chapter 2, it's the same thing. You get to chapter 3, well, you really went wild. The first three verses start with aleph. The next three verses start with beit. The third three verses start with gimel. The fourth three verses start with dalet. And on down through. Why would he do that? Hey, it's a built-in budak. Maybe you don't know what that word means. If you've taken many tests and you've had to learn a lot of list of things, you fix up a strange little budak that makes the sentence. You know how you spell it out? Don't look at me like you don't know what that's all about. You students, I can tell. In other words, it's an aid for memory. He's putting together a way to memorize the book. It's beautiful. He doesn't want his people to forget it. When I did a little research on this, I talked to the local rabbi to find out some things about Dachau and some of the things they went through, and boy, was I impressed with his love for family. And you want to know something? Those Jews put us to shame often with their family. What are we doing to build this kind of stuff into our kids? So what? We get all of that good stuff on Sunday night if it's not getting transferred. If you're not going to pump it in, believe me, nobody else will. Jeremiah says in chapter 3 some stuff that is so significant. He works carefully in the rhythm and the poetry of it to put it so that it's easily committed to memory in that old Hebrew text. I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of his wrath. He has driven me and made me walk in darkness and not in light. Surely against me he has turned his hand repeatedly all the day. God, that's something, isn't it? He has caused my flesh and my skin to waste away. He has broken my bones. That's the picture of sin when you live with it and you live with it and you deny it and you won't repent and you won't confess. That's what happens. Turn over to chapter 3, verse 17. My soul has been rejected from peace. Oh, that happens. I have forgotten happiness. I say, my strength has perished, and so has my hope from the Lord. Ugh, I'm going under. I'm drowning. You ever felt like that? It's at those times you need what follows, and I think this is the only glimmer of hope that shines in through the light in this funeral parlor of Lamentations. The next several verses. Just let them speak to you as I read them. Remember my affliction and my wandering, the wormwood and the bitterness. Surely my soul remembers and is bowed down within me. This I recall to my mind, and I have hope. Hope is now revived. What revives it? The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I have hope in him. He had just said, I'm losing hope. And then God gives him this glimmer of reminder. You have hope only in me. The only way you can get out of the pits is to look up, because I am the only one that can change your life. Turn it over to me. And then right back down deep again, verse 46. All our enemies have opened their mouths against us. Panic and pitfall have befallen us. Devastation and destruction. Now watch what he says about his weeping. My eyes run down with streams of water. Verse 49. My eyes pour down unceasingly without stopping. Verse 51. My eyes bring pain to my soul. 54, waters flowed over my head. I called on thy name, O Lord,
out of the lowest pit. This past week, one of our mothers in our church called me and wanted to bring me up to date on the condition of their home with their daughter. I asked permission to share it anonymously. She said, if it will do any good, share it. They have a daughter who has had her first child out of wedlock. They're helping to raise that son. And in the years that followed, the daughter married a non-Christian. She herself is a Christian. And again, became pregnant, and the man left, and she bore the second child without the assistance and aid of her husband. And in the despair of that consequence, the gal ran away. And while away, she fell into such a depression that she stabbed herself 3 times in the chest, just below the left breast, 3 times, in hopes of killing herself. Miraculously, she did not die. She called her mother and asked for permission to come home, and she stumbled in the door with a hotel towel rolled up, holding the wound. They helped her through that. She has now run away again, and as of our latest conversation with her just this afternoon, she still hasn't come home. Out of the lowest pit. Why do I linger on this so long? Because we need to see the dark side of the consequence of sin. We don't hear enough about it. It's the world in which many a person lives simply because he hasn't turned to God in obedience. And it is not satisfying. It is horrible. The lesson that comes through chapter 3 is this. When consequences come, there is never any reason to blame God. The prophet admits openly that it is the fault of the city. It is the people's responsibility. You will never come fully clean with your life until you take full responsibility for it. When consequences come, there is never any reason to blame God. Now, we get to chapter 4. It sounds like there might be hope. When a person is in that kind of lifestyle, he amasses to himself on occasion a rather nice nest egg, some a fortune. I mean, after all, not all who are in sin are poverty-stricken. As a matter of fact, they often seem to have it made. While ripping off other people, they gain an enormous fortune. But look at what begins to happen to the possessions. They speak, verse 1. How dark the gold has become. How the pure gold has changed. The sacred stones are poured out at the corner of every street. The precious stones of Zion weighed against fine gold, how they are regarded as earthen jars, the work of a potter's hands. Boy, isn't that eloquent? How empty and unsatisfying are the very things we stuck our hopes on. Gold tarnishes. Rings seem insignificant. A pot of money looks like pottery. When you can't find peace in your life. Verse 5. Those who ate delicacies are desolate in the streets. Those who were reared in purple embrace ash pits. For the iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the sin of Sodom. Verse 9, better are those slain with the sword than those slain with hunger. They pine away, being stricken for the lack of the fruits of the field. Verse 10, if you can handle it. The hands of compassionate women boiled their own children. They became food for them because of the destruction of the people. Let me give you the truth, and then I want to talk about it. Sin's consequences bring the very things we said would never occur. The chapter is full of such illustrations. When you suffer the consequences of sin, you experience the very things you said would never happen. You will be appalled at times how precisely God brings his judgment. The person who takes money that isn't his thinks, I'll never get caught, and he gets caught. The couple that compromises sexually says, we'll never be found out, and they're found out. The person who plays with drugs and says, I'll never get an addiction, gets hooked. The woman who says, I'll never stoop to those depths, stoops to those very depths and even worse. Or we say positively, hey, I'll keep on being satisfied, I'll have peace, and it's taken away. Riches profit not in the day of wrath, writes Solomon. The very things that we think will never happen are precisely the things that occur. It's almost ironic. No, it's sovereign. Finally, in chapter 5, the cry is, remember, Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our reproach. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our houses to aliens. Isn't that an awful thought? We have become orphans without a father. Our mothers are like widows. We have to pay for drinking water. Our wood comes to us at a price. Our pursuers are at our necks. We are worn out. There is no rest for us. Verse 9, we get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. Our skin is hot as an oven because of the burning heat of famine. They ravished the women in Zion, the virgins in the cities of Judah. When the armies came in Babylon, they took advantage of the women. It always happens in warfare. Princes were hung by their hands. Elders were not respected. Youth stumbled under the loads of wood. Young men from their music are gone. The joy of our heart has ceased. Our dancing has turned into mourning. Our crown has fallen. We have sinned. Final lesson, there is no misery greater than the misery following open disobedience. I think that's been said enough for us never to forget it. While you're finishing up your thoughts with me in this study, let me share with you sort of an enduring principle that comes out of this whole book. God gave it to me a Friday evening when I really needed a sort of a summation for all that I had seen in this passage. J. Sidlow Baxter's words, high calling flaunted by low living leads to deep suffering. High calling flaunted by low living leads to deep suffering. Following the first evening message, a lady who had recently been at Dachau came up to talk with me. She said, we have been there a number of times, and there's a very strange phenomenon connected with that place, aside from just the awful depression accompanied from that comes to you while you're there. You walk around the sites, and you see the ovens that have been preserved, and you see the statues, and you read the sign, remember the victims. But she says, in my 10 times that I have been there, the sun has never shone. And whether it's a little tradition or whatever, those villages about that area have that same belief. No matter how bright it may be in other parts of Bavaria, it doesn't shine at Dachau. I know a man who helped bring deliverance in the great victory of the Second World War in the interiors of Germany. And he said, you cannot believe the humanity that crawled out of those places. His hair has virtually turned white from what he saw. Remember the victims. I guarantee you the enemy has heard what you have heard in this message, and he stands ready with a whole new strategy to wink in your direction and say, ah, but this time it's different. That is a lie. You have heard the truth, and it could never be more the truth than it is from this book. Remember, remember it. I plead with you. Let's bow together. In the quietness of this meeting, before the activity of the night and the week that's before you, God has given us a moment to take a very deep look into a part of life that all of us had rather pass by. It is neither encouraging nor is it pretty, but it is real. Well, you know who you are, and I have no one in mind, but I must say here, some of you are not living like you should. And that's why God brought you to this message. I believe He sovereignly chooses those that need to hear certain truths. Oh, you're not very far down the road, but you're just dangerously near that final step. And maybe that's the whole reason God said, I want the book of Lamentations preserved. I want to capture that life before it's too late. If you've never turned your life over to Jesus Christ, please understand that's basic, that's first. If you have, that's not an automatic guarantee for purity. That really means the battle starts. Jesus says, I'll take you all the way, but I want you to model my Father's holiness and purity. And I see those little things that have no business taking so much of your attention and time, and I want them stopped. As a child of God, I leave it between you and Him. The warning is serious. Father, before we slip out into the night, I pray for a deep and abiding sense of your presence and your help, especially for the strugglers, for the ones who haven't turned the corner yet, but have been courageous enough to come and to listen. I pray for a listening ear and for a teachable spirit. I pray as well for parents who have perhaps loosened their grip a bit, not wisely, but out of laziness and even indifference. And I pray that you would assist them as they put together a plan to help commit these truths to their family. I pray for strength and purity in my own life. I thank you for preserving me from the pitfalls that I have been dangerously near many times. And I pray that you would assist the men who travel, the ladies who are often in their career or at home alone, the young people who are in places of tremendous temptation. And I pray that your voice would be greater than the voice of the tempter, and your word more significant than the wooing of the flesh. Remind us of what we have learned, and most of all, help us to remember the victims. In the name of Christ, the victor, we pray. Amen.
The preceding message, Lamentations, A Prophet's Broken Heart, was copyrighted in 1980, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2011 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.